This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to The Morning Run with Shazana, Noel, and Chuang. In the meantime, though, we are also reflecting on another commemoration or anniversary of sorts, and that is on 9/11, which is tomorrow.
Ever since the US declared a war on terror in response to the September 11 attacks in 2001, the mission and goals of the effort have gone through many iterations as the level and scope of the threat has changed over time. 20 years later, after two US-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that killed tens of thousands of civilians and trillions of dollars spent, I think the threat of attacks really still looms large, although perhaps different than it did in 2001.
Well, there are concerns that recent events, particularly the American military's departure from Afghanistan, could increase the ability of these terror networks to grow. Experts are warning that the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan and the recent troop withdrawal could increase the ability of such groups to organize and proliferate in a way that they've not been able to in years. So as we mark the new eve, the eve of September 11th, we ask how has terrorism evolved and if counterterrorism efforts have been effective?
So to share his perspective, we have Professor Greg Barton from Deakin University on the line. Good morning, Greg. Thanks so much for speaking with us today. So as we reflect on the eve of 20 years since 9/11, how has this event changed international discourse and response to terrorism? I mean, beyond simply an attack that happened in and to the US.
That's a really good question. I mean, we can't imagine an attack of that scale not having some sort of response from the US and partners. But we can imagine a very different response. So within 2 weeks, a little over 2 weeks after the attack, US Special Forces teams were hunting Osama bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership. They were very nearly successful, and indeed, to a large extent, they were successful. And that whole operation might have stayed with that narrow focus, but it morphed, it morphed into a nation-building exercise because the Taliban regime collapsed. Even that could have been kept small and well managed. It was basically bungled at every turn. But before that had gone 12 months, planners were working out the invasion of Iraq, and that was truly disastrous. That had lots of unintended consequences, including the rise of ISIS. So we could imagine a series of responses to the 9/11 attacks that didn't see the war on terror start. But it's the war on terror that really has changed everything rather than the attacks themselves.
So the war in Afghanistan was launched in response to 9/11. What are the implications of Taliban now ruling Afghanistan on counter-terrorism efforts in the Middle East?
Well, not just the Middle East, the entire world. It's pretty frightening because the Taliban are saying, with some credibility, that they've won the war. And al-Qaeda saying, we've won the war. The Taliban, our brothers, have won the war with us. And that means that the cause of Salafi jihadi struggle worldwide is winning. And so it means to groups, say ISIS groups in Mozambique or al-Qaeda groups in Mali or Shabab in Somalia, or I dare say Islamic State groups in Mindanao in the Philippines, it's an encouragement to keep on the long struggle because you're going to win. And there's the worry that Islamic State supporters everywhere, including across Southeast Asia, including potentially in Malaysia, will say, okay, we're on the winning side. We can't do anything big right away, but a few of us, maybe just me, I can go and do something. And that lone actor attack is an immediate risk. But the real risk is the longer term of people returning to Afghanistan to train in camps and back to the cycle of the 80s and the 90s that saw the rise of Jamaat Islamiyah in Southeast Asia, that being repeated across Africa and the Middle East and the rest of Asia as well.
Well, what does it mean for this global war on terror, Professor? And how can sovereign nations individually deal with it within their own domestic soil?
I think it's the question on sovereign nations is important because we can't really deal with it very effectively individually. One of the reasons why it was so hard to go after the al-Qaeda leadership is they escaped, many of them, across to safe sanctuary in Pakistan. And so, that immediately has been compounding the problem of dealing with al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. It's more complicated than that, but that shows the need for cooperation. There was cooperation with the Pakistani government, but, it was imperfect cooperation. In Southeast Asia, we know too well that groups don't stay just inside national borders. They slip across national borders. It's to their advantage. And in Australia, we're well aware that the bigger threats come offshore in our Southeast Asian region. So I think that old hackneyed phrase about we're all in this together has really been true when it comes to counterterrorism. The best work has been done by cooperation, sharing information. There was almost a terrorist attack in Sydney that involved a group mailing a bomb via Turkish Air out of Syria and wanting to blow up an Etihad aircraft flying to Abu Dhabi. They were stopped because intelligence on the ground in the Middle East passed on news to Australian authorities, and they tracked down the guys who had received the bomb in the mail. There are many, many stories like that we don't hear about of international cooperation. Sometimes it happens entirely within national borders, but very often there's an international component.
Well, more pertinently to the Americans' withdrawal from Afghanistan is the looming refugee crisis from Afghan refugees. You know, for recipient countries that are, you know, on humanitarian grounds receiving Afghan refugees, what is the possibility of infiltration by terror factions within the refugees? And how can recipient countries, you know, basically address the dangers contained therein?
Yeah, it's a genuine concern, but I think we need to sort of frame it in the broader context. What we've seen historically is terrorists tend not to hide themselves in refugee flows. It's too tricky and messy and inefficient. But what can happen is, if we don't treat refugees well, then some, particularly a second generation, might be vulnerable to being recruited and radicalized. So it's less that people would deliberately smuggle themselves into refugee flows because they've got other and more efficient ways of working. It's more that they will prey upon those refugee communities because there are traumatized, vulnerable people, and it makes it easier for recruiters. So it means that we, for humanitarian reasons, need to pay attention to helping refugees. And for reasons of security, we should actually, you know, try and make their lives as good as they can be and as interconnected with community leaders and social networks, with religious leaders and communities, so that they aren't going to be drawn away by some outsider coming in. We've seen this with the Somali refugee community around the world, the diaspora in Australia and the UK and in the US and Europe, where recruiters have gone after second generation families that have established themselves and doing well, but the second generation are a little bit lost, and that's where recruiters prey. So basically it's a case of double benefit. Doing good for helping people actually makes us more secure.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, earlier you mentioned that it was really the global war on terror that kind of changed the effort against counterterrorism or terrorism and, you know, just the whole sphere. My question is, how do we reconcile or how do we address the fact that counterterrorism and this global war on terror has been used as an excuse to clamp down on dissent and dissidents in certain countries? You know, where do we draw the line between what is legitimate counterterrorism action versus state oppression?
I think the first thing is we need to be honest with ourselves and take stock. You know, this 20 years on from 9/11, take stock of what's happened the last 20 years. Brown University has a unit called the Costs of War Project, and they're doing that sort of cost accounting, saying that 1 million people have died in the last 20 years, 38 million have become refugees or displaced, and the US has spent $8 trillion. So that's sort of looking at what's gone right, what's gone wrong is helpful. But more specifically to the question, what we're seeing is that countries that don't have good governance or are very authoritarian justify a crackdown on certain groups in the name of terrorism. I mean, Myanmar's a good example with the Rohingya. There's lots of issues in Myanmar, but there's not really a big problem with terrorism amongst the Rohingya at the moment. We might make it that way, the way they're handling it. And that's the point, that this sort of crackdown actually makes things worse. It leads to humanitarian disaster, but it also means it's more likely that at some stage you're going to have a backlash and an effective response from an insurgency. Amongst governments or states with more stable government, the problem is often unintended consequences. In the US, there's been a very heavy militarization of local police forces and a heavy hand on surveillance, and that's often counterproductive. It's probably contributed to the rise of far-right extremism in the US to a significant extent, which is where three-quarters of all the terror attacks have come from in the last decade. So we've got to be careful of unintended consequences. We've got to be transparent. We've got to be honest with ourselves. And we've got to build trust and work with communities. And when we see those things not happening, we've got to call it out.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, I just want to get your view about funding. Are we doing enough to kill the sources of funding terrorism?
I think financial intelligence is more the point. It's, you know, some people say, let's stop the oxygen flowing to the fire. We can't stop the oxygen flowing to, you know, the funding oxygen flowing to the fire of terrorist groups. but tracking it's important. So the financial intelligence part of it's very important. But that reminds us that that whole intelligence piece in general is what's given us success. That's where the Royal Malaysian Police has been so successful in just paying a lot of attention. And that requires tracking funding, yes, but also building relations with communities and listening to people and being alerted when something seems to be being developed that we need to intercept and hopefully prevent a plot being executed.
Greg, thanks so much for your insights. Fascinating stuff. That was Professor Greg Barton from Deakin University reflecting on counterterrorism efforts internationally 20 years on from 9/11.
Yeah, you know the $8 trillion that America spent on the so-called war on terror. In fact, they never found weapons of mass destruction anywhere, right? Imagine how much money, how much benefit to the American society would have happened if they had spent that money on stadiums, homes, affordable housing, education, healthcare, for example. $8 trillion is a lot of money. And I wonder how instructive Afghanistan is going to be for Joe Biden's foreign policy.
Yeah, what I read is, some part of the money did go back to U.S. contractors who had to do whatever they did in Afghanistan. So there is some flow back into Americans, just whether the profits are, how those profits are actually shared.
Lockheed Martin, McDonnell Douglas, Smith & Wesson, things like that.
I was really struck by Greg's comments on unintended consequences. So, you aim to counter terrorism, but actually you've got other consequences that cascade from it, like the militarization of the police force, like the unintended, what do you call that, militarization of, refugee
groups. Of second generation refugees.
Exactly.
I mean, parents might not want it, but, the children might.
So
they might find, sympathy with them.
These are all things that need to be keep in track of when we talk about, counter terrorism. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.